Thank you. la noche muere, cuando se asoma la sonrisa blanca en la mañana de mi adversidad.
Sake, log off Facebook already. It's time for Quietus Hour. My name's John Doran, and in Luke's continued absence, I'm joined today by writer and comedian Mr. Stuart Lee.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So, you're in today, I think primarily you've got a book coming out soon, which is a collection, an anthology, I guess, of short prose pieces.
Yeah, I'd have come in anyway. Even if I hadn't, I'd have come in anyway.
So these pieces, like, they're mainly from The Observer, some are from The Guardian, and they're from between 2011 and
this year.
Earlier this year. Yeah. And the book's called Content Provider, and it's out on Faber. Now, the first thing, I must admit, the first thing cynically that I thought was, well, if you're being given an anthology of newspaper pieces, then I guess that suggests that your previous book for Faber, How I Avoided My Certain Fate, must have been a big hit.
Well, it wasn't a big hit, but I'm lucky in that I have what a lot of writers aren't lucky enough to have, which I have a point of sale. Which means for 200 nights of the year, when I'm doing gigs, I can sell books after them. So the amount I got paid for this represents realistically what they expect I personally can sell after gigs over the course of 5 years. So it's not rocket science. It's just I don't get those kind of. I'm not going to get those kind of six or even four, five-figure deals that you see, like, famous comedians on the telly in sitcoms and things getting, but I carry boxes of them round and I sell them off to gigs, which is kind of a weird thing, isn't it? It's happening to everything. All all artists of any sort now are becoming like the farmer's market. Because if you, you can't see a return from Amazon, you can't really from iTunes, because they're monopolies that drive the price down. So, we just have to take the stuff around. It always reminds me of going to see bands 20, 30 years ago. And I remember the guy from American Music Club saying that he made more money out of the 500 self-pressed copies of one CD that he sold after gigs than anything he ever did through Virgin. So, you know, I'm kind of out there working. And John Hegley said to me years ago, when I was thinking about giving up, he said, have a thing that you can give them afterwards, even if you make a loss on it, because then they remembered that they've got a thing of yours in their house, and they remember that they like you and they came back. So, but Faber, I mean, I think it fits Faber's brand now. You know, they're sort of trying to do people like Julian Cope and slightly people that I suppose fall between low culture and high culture in some funny way. And also, it's not just an anthology of those pieces. It's accidentally ended up with having a kind of shape to it because of the big vote last month. You know, this is sort of in June. I mean, this is sort of 5 years of personalities that all ended up being sort of players in that. And or it's about the kind of shifts that drove us to that position in some way. So it's accidentally, it feels like a study of a period of time. And also, it's also about how you interact with readers, because I've used a lot of the stuff from the below-the-line comments, which I think is quite interesting modern phenomena, that nothing exists without the invitation of public comment now. So, and there'll probably be below-the-line comments on this, you know, so it's sort of about that as well.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. What prompted this idea to include the below the line comments? On first glance, a lot of them are kind of like lacerating towards you, but on second glance, maybe it does kind of make you look better, doesn't it? You know what I mean?
You've bewildered
quite a lot of your readers.
Well, I think it's important. There's interesting things about it. One is that that if a newspaper is going to invite below the line comment, then there's a possibility the writer will read it. And then the writer's further work is obviously going to be shaped by a response to that comment. Mm. So I think you need to sort of know that the part of why the voice begins to become more extreme and more mad is because of what people say about it. And so in the same way as with stand-up, you're sort of shaped by an audience response. You're shaped in the moment. The voice of these columns is sort of shaped by the response, not of the room, but of the people that post the comments up. And I also think it's obviously not happening in a split second thing like a stand-up's response. It's happening over the course of weeks, but it is happening. And I also think the violence of some of them, helps you to understand the violence and the hatred that there is around politics now.
Mm.
I also think it's interesting when what you do is completely misunderstood. And I think part of the problem, it also reflects the problem now that Trump and Boris and, you know, that they say things that are beyond parody. Mm. And Boris writes things in his columns that are genuinely appalling. So why would people assume what you were doing is a joke, or that it was meant to be satirical in some way, because actual discourse is so insane now. So I think it is worth putting the below-the-line comments in. I think some of them are really funny as well.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that the level of hatred that people have for me, it inspires them to come up with quite funny things.
Well, do you think there's a parallel to be drawn between the heckler and the vituperative commenter?
Yeah, I do, definitely. But there's also a sort of impotence about them. There's a kind of people that... You could write 1,100 words on how you didn't like tomato soup, right? And there's a certain kind of person that at the bottom would always put, "How brave going after tomato soup. We look forward to your article on Islam with bated breath." Every week, whatever you write, somebody accuses you of being some coward because you haven't written about Islam, right? And so there's always the same things come round and round again. Also, the same people come round and round again under different names. with false identities, and you sort of start to get a feel for who they are. And some of them I've worked out who they are. They're people that I used to know or whatever. And also, totalitarian states like Russia and China have, if you write anything about Russia or China, you get these demented things that are clearly generated by the...
I've got to say that was one of the really most jaw-dropping things about the book, where for those who don't know, Stuart wrote a column and you were advised by, was it your brother-in-law?
Was it your brother-in-law who told you about this?
If you write about the kind of Russia, then paid spooks, I guess.
So, I mean, if you've written a funny newspaper column about Russia or China, and you've, and, okay, right, here's, I write a thing about when we were doing trade deals with China, which might be off now anyway, because we've suddenly thought the world's unstable. Do we want them to control our nuclear power stations? But, you know, so I write this thing about how a massive Chinese arse has been rolled through London and all the politicians and dignitaries have to line up and kiss this arse or lick it. And they can't work out from the translation whether they're supposed to lick it or kiss it. And Corbyn and the Queen are trying to work out between them whether they're supposed to lick the Chinese arse or kiss it. Anyway. Then one of the below-the-line comments is this. What Lee fails to mention is that Xi Jinping has overcome the most extreme adversity to achieve the leadership of the world's second nation. Normally, such a feat of human achievement would be both recognised and held out as an example to others. In brief, his father was falsely imprisoned during the Cultural Revolution. Jinping was sent away to work and missed much of his secondary education. He became secretary. He goes on and on like this. That is not a member of the public, is it? That is someone... being in a sort of office in China, being whipped to write comments. So you kind of get a feel for where these things are coming from. And it, of course, it's no surprise then the idea that Russia might be having doing cyber attacks on America or trying to influence the discourse through online trolling, because they do it to me, right? If they'll do it to me, they'll do it to Hillary Clinton, won't they?
So when we invited you in, we asked you to select 9 songs to play, and I think we should crack on with a bit of that now. Now, the first track you've chosen is The Curragh of Kildare by Dexys, which is taken from their recent album Dexys Do Irish and Country Soul, and I was just wondering what made you pick this track.
Well, I really liked Dexys as a kid. In fact, they were about the third band I ever saw, and one of the first stand-ups I ever saw was... back in the old days before there was comedy clubs around the country, when alternative comics used to open for bands. I saw Peter Richardson opening for Dexys about 81, 82, which was really great. They make it hard for you to like them. You know, they disappear for years on end, and then Kevin Rowland would come back with that solo album where he was...
Mind Beauty.
I know,
it?
With yeah, the most yeah. bewildering cover ever, but... this new album, I thought, I'll give it a go. And it is really great. It's like they've sort of decided to record in character as an old sort of Irish show band that feel like they've been on the road for years and are playing in a way that's slightly on the edge of cheese, like, but very sincere, covers of famous songs and Irish traditional songs. And I think this Curragh of Kildare is amazing. It's got all the brilliant madness that you like about Kevin Rowland, where you never know quite what he's going to do. Insane, audacious noises, a ludicrous female vocal on it that's on the point of being ridiculous, but it's still absolutely brilliant. And I think it's great, and it's also nice because a lot of these, you know, it's school holidays time, and so the kids are having to put up with what I listen to, and they've really gone for this record. So Dexys, brilliant.
The rose upon the briar and the water running clear, lend enchantment to the linnet and the bee. Their little hearts are blessed, oh, but mine can know no rest. Oh, my true love is far away from me. Oh, it's straight I will repair to the Curragh of Kildare. For it's there I'll find tidings of my dear. A livery I will wear, and I'll comb back my hair.
Yes, he will. Yes, I will.
And in velvet shades of green I will appear. Oh, yes, this I'll undertake for my own true lover's sake. And she lives in the Curragh of Kildare. Oh, straight I will repair to the Curragh of Kildare. Because it's there, I'll find tidings of my dear. Cannot it remove?
That's me too.
I pity the pain, yeah, that you endure.
You got experience.
For experience lets me know, whoa, that your heart's a fool. Straight I will repair to the Curragh of Kildare. Because it's there, I'll find tidings of my dear.
Everybody sit.
And this street I will repair to the Curragh.
Counterintuitive decision to go up the octave at, yeah, the end is really amazing.
So that was Dexys, having ditched the Midnight Runners section of the name a few years back, and Curragh of Kildare. Dexys, I find, are untouchable among music journalists, or certainly among music journalists that I know. And I was wondering, you hinted at it just then, they kind of play a role. It's almost like they're in that tradition of adopting characters and sometimes, yeah, singing music about singing music.
Well, I never, you know, if you'd asked me 5 years about that idea, I would have found it insincere. But now that I do, you know, I have to do hundreds of gigs a year, and I choose to, and I a lot of the stand-up shows that I write, they have an emotional intensity to them that is difficult to reproduce genuinely night after night. So I have to sort of go into a kind of character. And now I look at what Dexys have done, for example, and I see, oh yeah, he's basically, I mean, he says in the sleeve notes for that album, actually, Kevin Rowland, that he got the photos done before they started recording, so they sort of knew who they were, what they were supposed, yeah, to look like. And and I remember, you know, 30 years ago, that, well, for one album they were like an Italian street gang,
yeah,
and the next album there's this ridiculous kind of plastic paddy idea of Irish tinker musician. You know, yeah, so, yeah. But actually, looking back on it, what that meant was he had very clear parameters,
yeah,
for those records of what the character of the band was. And Dylan seems to do a very similar thing, doesn't he? He sort of takes on different personas for different records. And I suppose what I do with the, you know, what is, I'm not saying I'm the same as them, because they're much better at what they do than I will ever be. But the newspaper columnist, Stuart Lee, who's collected in this book, is not the same as the stand-up. The stand-up's trying to provoke an audience in a room. He's trying almost to give a good account of himself to his betters, the metrosexual readers of a broadsheet newspaper. He's trying to sort of use the words that he thinks they would like and take these positions. So, you know, And I also found it helpful to think of myself as a kind of hack writer, particularly when I did one every week for about 6 months when David Mitchell was away for ages. I went to a cafe in a London tourist attraction, which I write at, well, I will not disclose the location of. And I'd get there by 10 in the morning after school drop-off, line up a load of coffees and give myself a kind of six-hour window to kind of knock it out like a hack. And if I could have worn a little hat and smoked a cigarette and had light coming in like through the blinds that are here, I would have done it like that. So I sort of thought, oh yeah, I'm this deadline bloke, you know, I've got to do this today. And so, yeah. But they take on these roles, and the role Dex have got for that new album, it's very heartwarming idea, but also ridiculous. I could see why people would hate it as well as love it. Yeah.
I have to say that to a certain degree, I have sympathy for anyone who does a regular column for a newspaper. I did a weekly column for Vice, and it is maddening having to come up with the source material and to come up with fresh ideas. What I was really, really impressed with about your book is how formally you try a different new idea with each column, which is, let's face it, it's not what Rod Liddell does.
Well, thank you very, very much indeed, John. I'm really, really, like, I'm really grateful for you to say that, because I did try to do that, and I've put in ones that I don't think necessarily quite worked, but I didn't write each one of, like, here's what I'm annoyed about this week. I tried to do things that were, like, weird fiction, things that were exposed the exoskeleton of me actually talking about, I've got to hit this deadline, but the news story I was writing about has changed. I'm in a hotel room in Leeds, and I've got to file this by 6 tomorrow morning, and this is what I'd write some of them like that. Some of them are, I would get huge blocks of text from other columnists' columns, like A.A. Gill one, or Peter Oborne from The Telegraph, or ones by people from UKIP and whatever, and just sort of cut them up into bits, like William Burroughs kind of thing, and then change some of the words. And those were amusing, because sometimes I'd get criticised by the supporters of those people for bad writing, whereas in fact all I'd done was entirely reproduce, largely word for word, someone else's thing, but just change the odd noun in it. And so I tried to sort of think. I wrote a piece for you actually years ago about Robert E. Howard.
And
I realised as I get older that I quite, as much as I like free jazz and whatever, I also like genre in music and literature where people got a set of parameters. Because once you know what those parameters are, you can really enjoy how they're messing with the formula. And the parameters of a newspaper column, people sort of know what it's supposed to be, so then you can kind of ruin it. But it's still, if it's the right length, it's still technically a newspaper column.
So I had a guess at which artists you were going to select. I only got two of them right. I only got Shirley Collins and The Fall. Now, I think The Fall, it was kind of a given, but I was kind of quite surprised by your choice, which is a live version of the early 90s single Free Range from the Creative Distortion live LP. This is the million-dollar question for any Fall fan, isn't it? Why would you pick this particular track?
Well, all these songs are the things I've been listening to in the last month. So they're a funny selection. They're things I've been working on, they relate to work, or I've had them on in the car with the kids in school holidays because I think they'll like them and I like them as well. The Fall one was, I'm writing a new stand-up show. Obviously, it's going to be influenced by Brexit. It's unavoidable. It's difficult to write at the moment because the whole Brexit news is still in flux and every day it changes. And one of the things I do when I do stand-up shows, I think very carefully about what music is playing in the room as people go in. And then the weird thing about The Fall is he's written so much and his words are so brilliant that you can normally find something that's appropriate to anything. I thought, yeah, there's that Free Range. It's Europa, Europa, every second, third word, Europa. I thought, oh God, you know, that's like now. So I listened to as many versions of it I could find, and I'd forgotten about that one because they normally don't keep songs in the repertoire, and it was a 10-year-old song at that point. But they did some strange one-off recording where they played loads of the hits just once for some DVD, and it's from that. And I do love it when they go back to old songs, though, because the chances are the lineup weren't even born when the thing was recorded, so they do come to them with a different feel. And this is much more like it was a piece of sort of you know, post-rave electronica, that the first version of that, and this version of Free Range is like the Stooges doing it or something. But yeah, I mean, what would you do without the Fall?
To talk to no one over the long, long, long days, and the year 2000, trouble and Moldavia, I pray. Thank you. summer without elders. This is the winter of your malcontent. This is the spring of your mental disorder of ruin.
Modernity. Modernity. What is it? Who can say? Wafer Lane 179, postcode LNQ, Western Quarter. ZDX. Red Stripe, Bidec, Tents and Tomatoes in Blackpool, Lancashire, where Jimmy Bloomfield has been brought back from the ice, this former soccer ace, to host jousts in modernity. One of the many football grounds that have been converted to hold this revived jousts in modernity. Sporto, from today and forthwith. Jousts in modernity. Charred landscape, watching the female bouts at the beginning beneath of the tent bedecked terraces. I exclaim out aloud, it's too drafty here. Those girls catch their death of cold. I'm shoved to the left by the bearded steward, but every movement my companion captured. I'm completely deaf. So cannot gauge my own voice volume. Large tomatoes on golden beige striped tents, plunked on brand new soccer terraces, seem to symbolise modernity.
Modernity indeed. The Fall, Free Range, live from Creative Distortion. Again, another difficult question. Do you have a particular Fall gig which you feel was like the best time you ever saw them? Or?
Well, the first time I ever saw them was at a rock festival in Cornwall called the Elephant Fair in 1984, and it was a huge big deal for me for loads of reasons, partly because I always wanted to see the Fall as a teenager, but growing up in Birmingham, which had really weirdly tight licensing laws because of its Quaker history, it was quite... You could probably get to see Big Country at the Birmingham Odeon, but to get to see a mid-scale band at a smaller club if you were 13 was going to be more difficult. And I said to my mum the summer after O-levels, look, the Fall are on at this festival in Cornwall, can I go? And she said, on your own? I went, yeah. And she went, no. And I went, go on. And she went, all right, you can go, but not with my blessing. And of course, all the things she was worried about happened. I was spiked with LSD. I slept under a tree and ended up in hospital the next day with some stomach disorder. But I did see the Fall playing with the back end of the original two drum kit lineup just after Brix had joined, doing songs from Perverted by Language, and then the next album that wasn't out at the time, which was The Wonderful and Frightening World of, and it was all lit by torches, and I was on my own, which was great. The best way to see the Fall, on your own. And the whole night was amazing. I mean, I saw this bloke came out earlier, hippie bloke, playing acoustic guitar through an Echoplex for about an hour. Absolutely amazing. I was going, who's that? It was John Martin. I'd never heard of him. So I went and bought a John Martin record. And, of course, all the records at that point were John Martin, were terrible Phil Collins jazz funk, just rubbish. But for some reason, That's the Taste Police going by when I'm talking about the 80s John Martin albums. But for some reason, for that one-off day, he'd played like a Solid Air type Live at Leeds kind of set. It was absolutely amazing. And earlier on the same day was Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers. Again, I didn't know who they were, but sort of saw them by accident. And also loads of the early stand-ups were on in those days. They weren't in theatres, but they'd be doing like the hippie festivals. And so I saw Hegley and the Propticians, and I think Jenny Eclair, and you know, things like that. So it was really fantastic, and I'm really glad that I saw one of the last of those sort of 70s type festivals. It wound up pretty soon after. So the rock festival is a very different animal today than it was then. So yeah, that was probably a big deal seeing the Fall. But I mean, so many times I've seen them going on for 50 times now, and you can't really get a fix on it. It's a bit like you've chosen to support some football team and you're going to go whatever happens, and the drama of it is always... I'll tell you what, in about May, they did four nights at the Garage, and I went to three of them. They're absolutely superb. I mean, like, they're just... When it's working, it's just astounding that it's still functions in that way. You know, brilliant.
I feel like the live, how good they were live with that setup didn't quite transfer onto what they were putting out via Cherry Red. However, I have to say that I have full faith that there seems to be a little bit of flux in the Fall camp at the moment. Mm. Not something that I want to speculate about, but if there is going to be lineup changes, I have every faith that they're going to do some good stuff in the future. Because it always, you know, once you, like you were saying about Perverted by Language was the first Fall album I got, and obviously, you know, like Bad Acid, it comes and goes in waves, you know. So, like, I'm on a bit of a dip at the moment with the Fall, but like I say, if I feel it in my water, the next album's going to be a cracker, I think.
Yeah, but I think where one is with the Fall, if you're someone that listens to them for a long time, often says more about where you are as well.
Yeah.
What your beat, you know, what's your, you know. And actually, for example, when the Fall were on at the All Tomorrow's Parties that I'd chosen the lineup for, I actually found it very difficult to watch them because there were such levels of stress and tension already around that weekend and me having to deal with it, that to deliberately introduce a level of creatively assembled rage and frustration was too much. You know, and I saw there was a funny parody on the internet on one of those sort of British Onion type sites saying that... you know, a middle-aged dad who does the school run twice a day and has a stressful job finds he can no longer listen to the Fall. You can't, because you kind of can't almost... Yeah. You can't really cope with it. And again, you need energy, in a way, to go. It's not relaxing. It's not something that takes your mind off things. It focuses you on all the things that are stressing you out, you know.
So going from one extreme to the other, I guess, we've got Trembling Bells. Now, what can you tell me? I know this is a very kind of well-regarded band, a very well-loved band. What can you tell me about them?
They're sort of steered along by Alex Nielsen.